I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In a wild and remote tribal area of Pakistan, Al-Qaeda's number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, may be encircled by several thousand Pakistani troops. There are reports the Egyptian doctor, considered by many a mastermind of the September 11th attacks, has slipped the noose and already fled across the mountains into Afghanistan. For the latest, we're joined now from Islamabad, Pakistan, by Farhan Bukhari of the Financial Times. Welcome, Farhan.
Thank you.
Farhan, you've just come out of a military briefing. What are Pakistani officials saying at this point about Zawahiri's whereabouts?
Well, nobody here on record is conceding that to begin with, there's any information about the identity of who this so-called high-profile target really is. The high-profile target mentioned for the first time by General Musharraf, the Pakistani president, on Thursday. And they're also saying that there's a lot of speculation going on around on who this target, this individual, may be. They're saying that the Pakistani troops have so far not sighted either Ayman al-Zawahiri or Osama bin Laden, or for that matter, any of the other key leaders, and therefore they're not in a position to say if indeed any of these individuals, especially Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's been talked about so much, is trapped inside this cordon in a remote part of northern Pakistan.
What are they saying about the fighting itself?
They're saying that there are some casualties. Essentially, this is a 50-kilometer stretch of land close to the border with Afghanistan, and they say that the people, the militants who are there, getting some support from a local sub-tribe. They say that this sub-tribe, which has not been named, the tribe, is sympathetic, or there are some people there who are sympathetic to militants from outside. The military's chief spokesman, General Shaukat Sultan, was asked if there was any chance that there were gaps in the military's cordon which would allow anyone to slip out. And he said that the military's cordon is fairly tight, and he doesn't see the possibility of anyone slipping out easily.
Did anyone ask him about reports a Taliban spokesman speaking by satellite phone from southern Afghanistan reportedly says Zawahiri is in Afghanistan, having indeed slipped that cordon?
Well, that indeed was the context of the question that was raised with him, and he said it wasn't possible for anyone to slip out.
Farhan, very briefly, describe to us what Waziristan province looks like, where the fighting's going on.
This is an area that I traveled to last year, and it's an area which popularly is described by some as Pakistan's Wild Wild East, comparable to America's Wild West in the old times. Nearly every home has a couple of weapons. People generally are quite poor. They rely on farming and some agriculture, and it's an area which has traditionally been closed off to the outside world. Historically, the tribes who live in this area have defied attempts by successive governments and regimes to take charge of their territory. The British, the colonial administrators, tried and failed very badly. So what General Musharraf has done in terms of sending his troops to this area is really opening up a part of Pakistan which has remained closed for as long as one can remember.
This is flat farmland that then rises to the mountains that separate Afghanistan from Pakistan?
Well, parts of it is flat farmland, but a good part of it is mountainous too, which is exactly why people on the run, such as people who are being chased now by the Pakistani military, have many, many places where they can easily hide. There are caves all over the place. The territory is very hostile. But if you're from this area, used to the conditions, then I suppose you could be on the loose for a long time, and it would take very intense effort for anyone to catch up with you.
Farhan Bukhari of the Financial Times joined us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Farhan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
The president of Taiwan is calling for calm today after he and his vice president were slightly wounded in what was believed to be an assassination attempt. President Chen Shui-bian was grazed in the stomach while Vice President Annette Lu was hit in the knee. The shootings occurred while the two were campaigning in advance of tomorrow's election. Chen's party is in a tight race with the leading opposition party, the Kuomintang, or KMT. We're joined by Robert Marquand in Taipei for the Christian Science Monitor. And Robert, a violent incident right before a national election. Last week, of course, we had the Madrid train bomb before the election there. Are people there thinking that there's any connection, any sense of who's behind the shooting?
Well, I have not heard anyone connect this to the Iraq, Baghdad, Al-Qaeda, or Spain. The issues here on the island are far too palpable in just local politics for there to be considered any kind of international terrorist incident.
Right. You write in your article today that this election is being framed as the greatest battle in 50 years in Taiwan. 80% of the people are expected to turn out and vote. Tell us briefly what each of the candidates stands for and why this president might have been targeted.
It's really an election between a party which used to be a dissident renegade party back in the 1970s. That's the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party of President Chen Shui-bian, who suffered the attack today. That's a party that is very pro-Taiwan, pro-ethnic solidarity of Taiwanese people. He is pitted against the Kuomintang, the former nationalist ruling party, which is a party that's considered to be far more pro-rapprochement, pro-integration with China.
Given his politics, is there any sense of who might have wanted to attack the president?
Well, of course, that's a $1,000 question. Everyone's wondering right now. The whole city of Taipei is sitting in front of its television, and right now we're entering into a phase of rumors, with the KMT charging that this is possibly a false setup.
An election ploy.
With the DPP, Chen Shui-bian's party, extremely angry on television tonight, denying any possibility that this was a setup.
Hmm. What about a shooting itself? The president says that Taiwan has no security problems. Do people have access to guns in Taiwan normally?
This is highly unusual in Taiwanese politics. It hasn't happened before at this level. There's not easy access to guns. These were two homemade weapons. They're now identifying this as two shooters rather than one. People were thinking one bullet. How could that be? Mm. Now they're thinking it's two bullets. They've announced that they found two homemade gun cartridges on the ground near the spot of the shooting. The DPP is saying it wasn't a setup shooting because there was a caravan in which the president and the vice president were traveling through the crowds. And they said that jeeps were traveling too fast for there to be a setup shooting.
Mm. Well, finally, Bob, as we said, both the president and the vice president are fine. How is this expected to affect the election?
Well, that's a really good question. That's another one people don't know. Before this, there had been a feeling that the KMT, which is presenting itself as a more moderate party at this point, was ahead by as many as 800 to 1.5 million votes, which is very large in Taiwan. People do feel like this is going to create a sympathy factor for Chen Shui-bian, but no one is really feeling like that's going to be enough to push the election in the DPP's favor. Of course, nobody knows at this point because, for one thing, they haven't been allowed to take polls for the last 10 days.
Hmm. Well, Bob Marquand, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Marquand, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He joined us from Taipei, Taiwan. Clashes continue for a third day in Kosovo in the Balkans, but some calm has been restored. Additional NATO peacekeepers are being rushed into the region with orders to fire on anyone who violates the rule of law. The violence erupted after ethnic Albanians accused Serbs of taunting and then causing the drowning deaths of Albanian children. The majority Albanian population then attacked Serbian churches and homes. 31 people have died. Joining us now is Reuters reporter Doug Hamilton from the capital, Pristina. Doug, Kosovo has been under NATO control since 1999 when NATO troops stopped the ruthless cleansing of Albanians by Serbs. In this week's blow-up, the Albanians have been attacking Serbian churches and homes. We understand the region is calm now but volatile.
Well, Kosovo has really been volatile for a very long time, and including after NATO troops came in 1999, for a period of weeks, months even after that, there were quite a few revenge attacks by Albanians who had been repressed by the Serb minority. The lid was put on that after a while, but sporadic killings continued and abductions, and Kosovo's never really been a tranquil place in the past 5 years.
Well, this week's events have been huge. Hundreds of people protesting, churches burned, homes burned. As we said, the Albanians claimed Serbs taunted young children and chased the children with a dog, and they were drowned. The Serbs also say a young man was shot the day before. But what are the current underlying tensions that created this week's violence?
Well, the thing that was noticeable about this week's violence, quite unique really, was the fact that it spread like wildfire. Mm. There have been eye for an eye incidents in the past when a Serb has been murdered and Albanians will take the Serbs will take revenge and vice versa. This time, the incident with the three children who drowned in the river, the background to which I must say remains murky, set off demonstrations in a town called Mitrovica, which is split basically between Serbs and Albanians, and there's a strong NATO and UN police presence there, but the rioting started there. However, it very, very quickly spread to other places. You see, the remaining Serbs in Kosovo, about 200,000 left when their troops pulled out in 1999, but there are, say, 80,000 who remain in Kosovo, and they're rather scattered, and they live in enclaves. Sometimes there are villages with only 100 Serbs in them, and the land and villages around are Albanian. NATO, at the beginning, tried to protect all of these places, but as years have gone by and the level of violence has seemed to drop, then the NATO force has been cut back from 45,000 to now 18,500.
Well, Doug,
I think this is a bit of a surprise.
Well, we should say many Albanians didn't participate in this week's violence. They protected their Serbian neighbors, further underscoring how complex this is. The ethnic Albanians want independence. The Christian Serbs do not. Just very briefly, we just have a few seconds. What is the sense of what happens next?
Well, this has been, if you will, swept under the carpet because it's a very, very difficult problem. There are 2 million Albanians here, very, very few Serbs left. It seems almost impossible to tell a population that they cannot have their independence and they must once again join up in some form of political union with Belgrade after all that's happened. No one sees quite how that can happen. At the same time, Kosovo is legally part of Serbia. It's been part of Serbia for down through hundreds of years of history. So what's going to happen next is a very, very difficult thing to predict. There will have to be talks. And, of course, what's the issue that's been raised this week is there going to be some sort of partition of Kosovo in the end?
Well, Doug Hamilton, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Doug is a Reuters correspondent. He spoke to us from Pristina, the capital of Kosovo.
Just ahead, a reporter's return to the changed but still charged streets of Baghdad.
And later, our review of the new film, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Here's what President Bush told Americans 1 year ago at the beginning of the American-led invasion of Iraq.
Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures, and we will accept no outcome but victory.
Today, 1 year later, we check in with WBUR's Michael Goldfarb, who joins us on the line from Baghdad. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Bill.
Michael, how are people marking the anniversary in Baghdad?
Well, actually, it's a curiously absent occasion here. It's Friday, which is the Sabbath here in Iraq, and it was comparatively quiet in Baghdad. I don't think people are marking it much in public. It may occur to some in their minds that it's a year since this all started. I think the Iraqis who seem most interested are those who are involved in trying to disrupt and wreck this whole situation, the terrorists, who of course have stepped up their campaign of activity over the last 72 hours. And on my drive to Baghdad from Erbil today, certainly there were many more checkpoints than there are usually on that road, as the American military is prepared for action around the anniversary.
How vulnerable do you feel driving into Baghdad, a civilian, not surrounded by armor or guns?
Once we got into Baghdad, I didn't feel particularly as if my safety was threatened. The overall impression I've had, though, in the week that I've been here, mostly in the north, is that people don't really pay attention too much. They are much more interested in, you know, the daily struggle just to get on, to go about their business. I think people's greatest concern is the personal security, the sense that, you know, at any moment a bomb could go off. They could be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Like the people who lived near the Jebel Lebanon hotel where that massive bomb went off earlier in the week. I drove past that site today specifically to have a look, and you look at that street and you say, what could possibly have been the target for that suicide bomber? And the conclusion has to be that the bomb detonated early. And this is the kind of fear, the security fear, that I think exists for almost all Iraqis.
You know, Michael, a year ago, President Bush, as we heard, talked about no outcome but victory. What are your thoughts on that statement as you stand in Baghdad today?
Well, it depends on how you define victory. I mean, if the idea was to change the regime, that certainly happened, and it happened very swiftly. If the idea of defining a victorious outcome is a stable, prosperous, democratic country, then there's a long way to go. I say when I talk to people here that I was here last year for major combat operations, which is, of course, the president's own phrase from last May. Major combat operations are over. I don't think that there's a war here. I don't get the sense that there'll be a civil war here in the near to midterm. I mean, it's always possible. But what I do get a sense of is that there's so much work to be done yet to be able to say that the president's idealistic desire to somehow change the regime here and begin a democratic society here, there's still quite a long way to go.
Michael, what sense of normalcy is there on the streets? Traffic is heavy, right? Do you see kids going to school?
Yeah, traffic is unbelievable. And one of the things, as you drive around Baghdad, and today it's easier to drive around than it will be tomorrow, I'm reliably informed. There are so many new cars here. I don't mean new hot off the factory assembly line, new to Iraq cars here. Bill, wherever you go in this city, on either side of the river, any kind of neighborhood, upper middle class, wealthy, working class, deeply impoverished, anywhere there's a couple of spare acres of ground, it is covered with cars for sale. It seems like every used car between here and London has somehow found its way to Jordan, been loaded on, you know, car-carrying trucks, brought to Baghdad. And this is, I think, a sign for people who are prospering, those who have jobs, say, with either the new government that's formed here, working for the CTA, subcontractors, whatever. They're going out, and the first thing they're buying is cars to get around town. Unfortunately, so many people have done it that it's virtually impossible to get around Baghdad. The one thing that I will say, Bill, that I find extremely odd is that, you know, I've been in a number of conflict situations over the last 10 or 15 years, and this is the first one I've been in where when you go down the road, there's no Red Cross cars, SUVs. There's no UN, SUVs, none of the major NGOs. To me, as someone who's been in a lot of situations of war, civil war, disaster, to not see those people participating in reconstruction here is a very, very strange sensation.
The fact that the NGOs and the Red Cross and so on and the UN are not there, what's the significance of that?
So long as the big organizations like the UN and the Red Cross have pulled back because of their security concerns, their very legitimate security concerns, it's hard to see how the outside powers, the rest of the world, can begin to help Iraq really rebuild itself. I think you need to get these people back in. And I just can't imagine how the United States alone can rebuild this country.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb joined us from Baghdad. Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us your town and how to pronounce your full name.
Next week on Here and Now, we'll talk to foreign editors about the relationship between the U.S. and Europe.
And a film about an African Christian who journeys to the Holy Land only to end up at a shopping mall.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Is it October? Given the intensity of the thrust and parry of presidential politics these past few weeks, it felt more like the election is days and not 8 months away. This morning, though, President Bush stayed above the political fray, honoring the first anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq War.
There's no neutral ground. No neutral ground. In the fight between civilization and terror. Because there's no neutral ground between good and evil, freedom and slavery, and life and death. The war on terror is not a figure of speech. It is an inescapable calling of our generation.
As for John Kerry, he's on a week-long vacation. He spent hours yesterday snowboarding on Idaho's Bald Mountain. A president being presidential, his presumptive opponent, well, off. To discuss these and other presidential campaign dynamics of the moment, we turn to two newspaper editors in two key swing states. Randy Wilson, editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Bill.
And Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, Guy.
Hello, Bill.
Guy, here's the dilemma for any challenger in any presidential race, isn't it? George Bush, somber, presidential this morning in the East Room of the White House. How does the Massachusetts senator compete with that?
Well, I don't think you can. I mean, the president is getting very good at these ceremonial style speeches, and I don't think that you can compete on that level. I would note, however, that his speechwriters are getting awfully good at commingling Iraq and Afghanistan as if they were one and the same thing. And I don't know whether you noticed he kept going back and forth, a sentence about Iraq, a sentence about Afghanistan. Most of the rest of the world sees them as two very different activities.
You know, Randy, one could detect political subtexts in this president's speech this morning. He said the fraying of foreign alliances is over, he said. Everyone agrees it's a good thing Saddam Hussein is gone. But, of course, one of the major points John Kerry will be bringing into the political fray is that our alliances are frayed.
The issue doesn't seem to be that the dictator has been deposed. It's actually winning the peace and the kind of sacrifices that still have to be made. And I think John Kerry still has some major points to make on that score.
Guy, what's smart and maybe not so smart about the Bush campaign going negative so early? At rallies, in a multi-million-dollar ad campaign, the president mentioning Kerry's name and getting real negative.
Well, I think that what's smart is that he's getting off some good cracks. I mean, they're good because they've got a ring of truth to them when he talks about flip-flopping and having two positions on all the issues. There's just enough truth to that in terms of Kerry's inability to explain himself that it makes for good politics without being quite as nasty as some campaigns I can remember in the past.
But, Randy, can it wear the public out when it happens so early?
It certainly can. We have kind of the leavening agent here in Senator John McCain, who's the most popular politician, and he has actually come to Kerry's defense and says he doesn't think he's weak on defense, pointed out that the Bush folks have actually voted against pay raises for the military. So it may backfire, particularly in this state.
McCain, you know, raises the point that this guy is strong on the military. He's been good on the military. He's been in the military, unlike Bush, or at least the active military. And when McCain was up here in New Hampshire campaigning for Bush, it was really remarkable. I wrote down what he had to say about Bush. He said, "I have some disagreements with him, but that doesn't mean that I think his overall record doesn't deserve reelection." I mean, diagram that sentence.
Kerry came out and said that foreign leaders backed him more than they backed President Bush. The Republicans assaulted him for that claim, and he hasn't named any names, Kerry has, but refused to back away from it.
Well, I think he's probably right. I think foreign leaders do support him more than they support Bush. The fraternity of foreign leaders for Bush is getting smaller with each election overseas, as you may have noticed. But I don't think it was very smart of Kerry to bring it up, because endorsements don't really do much in presidential elections, and endorsements from foreign leaders are even less effective, I think. But for many people in Europe and Asia and other parts of the world, this is more than that. Bush has taken this country in a direction that a lot of people overseas are particularly worried about. And so they're looking at this not really as a more partisanship, but as a real choice between sets of values.
On this first anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq, Guy, what are people in your community feeling about it?
You know, I haven't heard anybody talking about it in the community. I think people are awfully anxious about what's going on over there. I think everybody feels that, yes, it's not working out very well, but no, we can't just walk away from it. And so there are a lot of fingers crossed and a lot of people that are just hoping for the best and hoping that somebody has a solution here.
I mean, Randy, you don't hear from any political quarter except really way over on the left, pull out.
Well, we actually ran a front page question, and we've got about 50 or 60 email responses in just one day. It does kind of run the gamut here in a college town. There are those who feel disillusioned. They feel that their government has let them down. But others who kind of are thankful for a strong military, they appreciate the values and the sacrifices. I think overwhelmingly, though, the theme seems to be that they do feel less safe and that they're not sure that going to war in Iraq has made the world or, in fact, this country more safe. You may have seen the poll guide that C-SPAN released, asking them if their viewers, who are the people who are the political junkies, feel they have an influence on government policy. And what was it? Only 20% answered yes, which seems like a low number.
It's dispiriting.
It certainly is.
Speaking of polls, guys, I want to go back to Kerry for just a minute. A CBS News poll this week showed John Kerry's poll numbers dropping slightly while the president stayed the same. You know, one piece of tape we're certain to see again and again in Republican ads is John Kerry saying on tape, I think in the well of the Senate, that he both supported and didn't support the $87 billion supplemental funding bill for the troops in Iraq. That's the kind of thing that's a problem for John Kerry, right?
That's a cheap shot, though, because what he meant and what he in fact said, if you run the whole speech,
right,
is that he voted for repealing the tax cuts that the president had put in place in order to pay for the war. He didn't want to vote for spending an additional $87 billion off budget that would just add to the national debt and deficit.
Yeah, it is a bit shocking in a political race to see a cheap shot, I'll admit that.
I was just stunned that they would do that, yes.
But it does show, Guy, the dangers of going on vacation at this point in the race when, you know, for a couple of months they're framing the image of your opponent, and if you don't immediately counter that, you're in danger of having that tagged with you now for the rest of the race.
Well, as the poll indicated, Kerry was not doing all that well while he was campaigning. Maybe he'll do better when he's not campaigning. Who knows?
Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Thanks, Guy.
You're welcome, Bill.
And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Thanks, Randy.
And thank you, Bill.
Still to come, our review of the new Jim Carrey film, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
You're listening to Here and Now.
As we just heard, President Bush is calling the war on terror a calling of our generation. But Muslims around the world have increasingly begun calling it the New Crusades, at least according to Boston University law professor Susan Akram. She's presenting her ideas today at a forum at Boston College and joins us now. And, Professor, you say a majority of Muslims really believe that the U.S. war on terror is the New Crusades. What do you base that on?
Well, I really look at Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Palestine, Israel. Mm. And here, Arabs and Muslims make the connection between post-9/11 targeting of Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. and what is seen as a far longer period of targeting Arabs and Muslims, disregarding their lives and interests in the U.S.'s pursuit of economic and foreign policies.
You talk about the U.S. racializing Arabs and Muslims. What does that mean?
Yes. What it means is that it is creating them, turning them into an other, a stereotypical other that somehow sets them apart from the rest of us.
Another word for racializing is
racial profiling.
Yeah, profiling. And
yes.
How do you have this conversation now when there's a lot of resistance to it?
Well, it's a very difficult conversation to have. Racial profiling has a longer history, not just against Arabs and Muslims in this country, but of course we know from the African-American community. It has the same problematics and perhaps more in this context. Let me give you a simple example. Mm. There was a massive roundup of arrests and detentions after September 11th. Several thousand people were rounded up and detained. And many assumed that most of them, being non-citizens, that it was quite legitimate to target them. They all happened to be Arabs and Muslims. Well, as it turned out, now we know from the government's own reports that the people they were rounding up had had nothing to do with September 11th. What does that message send to the broader population, not just Arabs and Muslims, but other minorities in this country?
And, of course, it's also viewed abroad, and that gets us back to the Crusades.
Exactly.
Well, getting back to the idea of calling the U.S. war on terror a crusade brings one back to the history books in our mind. We think of the First Crusade, 1095, launched by Pope Urban II to seize the Holy Lands back from then the Turks. The Last Crusade, launched by the King of France a couple hundred years later. By then it was seen as being more of a political than anything having to do with religion or faith.
Mm-hmm.
Are people actually referring back to that time? I mean, how are they calling the U.S., the current U.S. war a crusade?
Well, of course, the language crusade was used by President Bush himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have seized on that as exemplifying what they see as a longer crusade.
Is it seen as a U.S. attempt to take back the Holy Land?
That is a part of it, and some of the discussion has focused on the fact that there have been Christian evangelists in Iraq now trying to convert people. This sort of fits into that narrative.
What, in your mind, should U.S. leaders learn from the Crusades?
The most important to me at the current moment is to start asking the broader questions. We might dismiss these other narratives, but we shouldn't dismiss them without examining them and examining the effect that they are having on our relationship with the rest of the world.
I was wondering if the other lesson was the Crusaders all lost.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think that occupation of other countries, of other lands, is also destined at some point to lose.
Professor, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Screenwriter Charlie Kaufman tells stories hard to describe and, for some, even harder to resist. In Being John Malkovich, Kaufman's character is paid good money to slip and slide through a portal into the cult actor's mind. Adaptation exposed the inner workings of a screenwriter struggling with his creative process. What was he imagining? What was real? What did it matter? The film was critically acclaimed. Well, now Kaufman and director Michel Gondry take on memory and love in the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The film stars Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet as lovers who, after they break up, decide to erase each other from their memories. In this scene, Carrie's character Joel finds out more about the procedure.
There's an emotional core to each of our memories, and when you eradicate that core, it starts its degradation process. And by the time you wake up in the morning, all the memories were targeted with withered and disappeared, as in a dream upon waking.
Is there any risk of brain damage?
Well, technically speaking, the procedure is brain damage, but it's on a par with a night of heavy drinking.
Well, to find out if Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is itself memorable, we turn to Here and Now film reviewer Eric Schaefer. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Robin.
I've seen clips of this, previews of this, and It looks fabulous. I wanted to say the title comes from a poem by the 18th century poet Alexander Pope, Eloise to Abelard. How happy is the blameless vestal's lot, the world forgetting by the world forgot. Eternal sunshine of the spotless mind, each prayer accepted and each wish resigned. Well, that explains nothing. Wait, tell us, is the film as bizarre as the title and some of the previews lead us to think?
Well, we're in Charlie Kaufman territory here, so it goes without saying that this is a bizarre film, a bizarre premise. You have these two characters, Joel and Clementine, who've gone through a love affair. It's over. And Joel discovers that Clementine has gone to this company called Lacuna that erases your memories. And so he decides to go through the same procedure. But there are complications. When Joel is having his memory erased, which takes place while you're asleep, a couple of the technicians, played by Mark Ruffalo and Kirsten Dunst, are busy partying while they're erasing this guy's memory. They're smoking pot, they're drinking, and things kind of begin to go awry there.
What should we do?
I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do.
What should we do?
Crap. I don't know. I just said that.
I'm sorry. What should we do?
I don't know. Mellow. You're freaking me out.
Mellow. We have to do something. He can wake up.
Okay.
I have faith.
Quiet. You're freaking me out.
And
have faith. Okay. So Joel is resisting the process there. He's decided he doesn't want his memory erased. He's resisting and actually moving through his memories and trying to hide Clementine in older memories, memories that she wasn't initially associated with. So we're talking some weirdness here.
Yeah, I understand that the film line jumps all over the place. As, you know, Memento and Pulp Fiction and Time Code are other films that have tried to play with the linear ness films,
right,
if you will. Is it successful in doing that? And how does the film look?
It's very successful in playing with the sort of non-linear quality of memory itself. And the film looks really interesting, too. It's very imaginatively shot in this very sort of low-tech kind of way. The film is set in the present, even though it's got these sci-fi elements to it. And they do a very imaginative job in dealing with the way in which Joel tries to sort of hide in his memories while this process is occurring.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that this film was written specifically by Charlie Kaufman for Michel Gondry, this wacky film director. But the last time the two of them teamed up, it was for a film called Human Nature, which you didn't like.
Yeah, Human Nature was a disaster. And I was, you know, admittedly really worried about this film because I thought, okay, are we going to be going back into the same territory again? But it's a completely different film. To see a movie like this coming out at this time of year is really sort of out of the blue. It's a real surprise because it's a film that's not even so much about the narrative, but it's really about memory. It's a meditation on memory, about love, about relationships. And the thing that's so great about this movie is the way that it inspires you, inspires the viewer to really reflect on your own life, the nature of memory, and to really consider how each one of us is made up of our memories. And when we begin to pare those memories away or when they begin to dissipate, we lose a little bit of ourselves. And so the movie is really sort of drawing on all of those issues. It's got a lot of laughs, but I think at the end of the day, you're really left with a real sense of poignance in this movie.
Hmm. Again, Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, did you like them? And it sounds like you like the movie.
Carrey is almost unlike any other Carrey you've seen before. I mean, he's given some really good, solid performances. But here he's very interior, very closed in. Kate Winslet is kind of kooky and crazy, but not always in a fun way. She's really pretty edgy. So, you know, this is really, I think, a breakthrough performance for Carrie and for Kate Winslet as well.
And one last warning from you.
Mm-hmm.
Be careful as you read the reviews, because you don't want to know too much when you go see this movie, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think this is a movie that you want to just sort of surprise you, and it's full of surprises, very pleasant and very profound surprises.
Eric, thank you.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Film reviewer Eric Schaefer's thoughts on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Blessed are the forgetful, for they get the better even of their blunders.
A quote from Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil, as spoken by Kirsten Dunst in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And the questions raised by Charlie Kaufman's new film do seem pretty profound. What are our memories? Do they make us who we are? If so, when we erase them or simply forget them, are we not us? Professor Dan Schachter is an expert in memory studies. He's chair of psychology at Harvard University. He's been looking at memory disorders for 25 years. And Professor, first of all, you've seen the film. What did you think of its treatment of memory?
Well, I thought it was extremely interesting from a number of perspectives. On the one hand, the premise that we could go in and find a memory and selectively zap it out or a whole series of memories is a little bit far-fetched, and both for technical reasons and because most of us don't think that memories are stored as little photos inside our brain. But on the other hand, I think the film did a good job of actually conveying that memory is a very much constructive activity. It did a good job of conveying how central memory is to personal identity and the kinds of confusion that can result when you lack parts of your memory.
Well, do you mind if I ask you about the technical part just for a second? Because that is the intriguing part to many of us. What is a memory? I mean, can you see where a memory is, those of you who study it?
Well, you really can't, because the kinds of memories that are portrayed in the film, memories for your past experiences, aren't stored in any one place in the brain. They're kind of stored in a more distributed manner with bits and pieces of different experiences are represented in different parts of the brain. It would be a really complicated matter to go in and find one single memory.
Are we ourselves if we forget things? Are we us anymore?
Well, it's an interesting question, and that maybe is the central question posed by the movie. And there's a sense in which you'd say no and in a sense in which you'd say yes. To the extent that you lack any critical bit of information about yourself, you could say that it's kind of a diminished self. On the other hand, there have been some very intriguing studies of patients who have brain damage that result in amnesia for their past experiences, where they can't remember many of the specific things that happened to them in the past. Nonetheless, if you have these patients, for example, rate their own personalities, they still pretty much rate themselves the way that other people rate them. So there are aspects of the self that may be able to survive the kind of memory loss that is depicted in the movie and other aspects of the self that may be affected.
You're a professor, but for a brief moment, can you be a film reviewer? Did you like it?
I love the movie. I think it's intriguing, and I'm eager to see it again.
Because you forgot it the first time? No, just kidding.
Haven't forgotten it yet.
Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Dan Schachter, chairman of the Department of Psychology at Harvard University and author of The Seven Sins of Memory. Well, we leave you to ponder with a song from Beck from the soundtrack to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Change your heart. Look around you. Change your heart, it will astound you. And I need your loving like the sunshine.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Everybody's gotta learn sometime. Mm-hmm.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.